Ransom 79 is a feature-length documentary about a ransom demand on the Irish government that's been kept secret for more than 40 years. It's the late Charlie Bird's last story as a journalist, and through the documentary he also shares his experience living with motor neuron disease. And accompanying Charlie on this, I suppose, the last job, is journalist and playwright Colin Murphy. And Colin joins me in studio. Good afternoon, Colin.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Congratulations on Ransom 79. It's in cinemas nationwide from Friday, May 24th.
Yeah, it's there already.
It's a fascinating story. I was saying to you before we went on air there's probably three things going on here. There's this story from 1979, which has remained a secret. Then there's Charlie Bird's story as he's coming near the end of his life. Mm-hmm. And then there's the story that we'll start with, the story of you and Charlie. Yeah. How did you first meet?
Yeah, that was the surprise to me. I had never realised that was going to be on screen. But back in 2015, Charlie got in touch with me through a mutual friend. We didn't know each other. And he'd got very caught up in the marriage equality referendum, essentially as an activist, because he'd retired from RTÉ at that stage. But he thought there was a story there that went a bit deeper than the story he felt the kind of news media had told. And he started doing interviews just with the ordinary people whose lives got caught up in it. And he was putting those interviews into a book with Kevin Rafter, was working with him on that. And at some point he had this idea, maybe there'd be a play in this. I never worked out where that idea came from, because he wasn't a theatre buff, you know. Anyway, he asked a friend, and the friend said, well, go and talk to Colin. So we met, and it was absolutely the opposite of what I'd expected. I'd expected this kind of hard-bitten hack, you know, this veteran news correspondent, been on war zones and stuff. And instead, he was like visibly nervous meeting me, kind of vulnerable, you know, self-conscious. He was stepping into territory he didn't know. Gave me this sheaf of transcripts of these interviews he'd done. I took one look at them and I went, this is absolutely a play. So I turned those into a play. It was called A Day in May. And we, you know, we worked together on that. It was kind of a lovely collaboration over a year or two. We stayed in touch, obviously, but then, you know, a few years ago, I got another
call.
Similar call from him, yeah.
Yeah. And you're sort of at the intersection of journalism, politics and the arts.
That's a good way to put it.
A lot of strings to your bow. Yeah. People may or may not know that you wrote the Charlie Haughey drama.
Yes. I wrote
the way you looked at me there, I thought, no, I didn't write.
I wrote a play called Haughey Gregory.
Yes.
There was separately a TV drama called Haughey, which wasn't me.
Wasn't you.
Another fellow is also a playwright, actually.
Right, okay.
But I wrote a couple of plays about the crisis that we went in, bank guarantee, and then the bailout, and we turned those into, the first one into a movie, the second one into a TV drama. So I'm playwriting and screenwriting. And
regular writer with the Sunday Independent.
Weekly column of the
Sunday Independent. Yeah, so you've a lot going on.
Juggling.
Fingering a lot of pies. So then Charlie, how many years ago, contacted you about this story?
It was about 3 years ago, yeah. I mean, he had his diagnosis. In the very early stages of it. He'd got this story. He was working on a podcast of the story, and he started to notice issues with his voice, started going for tests. That's quite a prolonged process. Though he always had a feeling, he was quite kind of fatalistic about, at that stage, that early sense. And so when he got in touch with me, he was realising, you know, he was determined to keep doing the story. He'd roped in a mutual friend and colleague, John Kelleher, film producer, with the idea of a documentary film, and he needed help on it. So he reached out to me. You know, we didn't know precisely what, actually I thought at that point probably more like script writing. Mm. And as we were working on it, you know, I mean, he needed help with the nuts and bolts. People know he's been using the voice app. You can't make a phone call with a voice app, you know, so the legwork, the journalistic.
He needed a sidekick.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And he knew you and he liked you. In fact, he loved you,
quite early in our relationship, he became, I think, I don't want to disparage my dad and my brothers and stuff, but like, we're Irish men. I think Charlie was the first and only man who ever said, I love you,
right,
to me. It came a little bit early in our relationship for me, but he, you know, he wore his heart on his sleeve.
He was effusive like that, wasn't he? Yeah.
He was, and I think that was a large part of the strength of his connection with the Irish people, you know. I've spent a lot of time with him now, and we've been out there, you know, kind of working together, and particularly during this last phase when he was also being very active with charities fronting campaigns to raise awareness of motor neuron and Pieta House and that. And people are incredibly warm towards him, and that's reciprocated. And it's not just a celebrity thing. There was something unusual there.
And maybe that vulnerability, people find that attractive, and it's easier to connect with somebody who's shown their own vulnerability.
Yeah, I think that's it. And it was bound up with an honesty. You know, it was an emotional honesty that carried over into a kind of a professional honesty. And so people, you know, from the ordinary people of Ireland to the IRA, literally, to government ministers, trusted him.
Yeah. We'll talk about the IRA, because you did ask him that question, had he still got contact with the IRA, some of his contacts from the 70s, 80s and 90s. But Ransom 79, so it was August 1979, and the Department of Agriculture got a letter.
Yeah, so it's a torrid time, first of all. You know, the economy's a basket case. It's the second oil shock. There were the most strike days in Irish history in 1979. So economically, basket case. Yeah. At the same time, the troubles in the north is literally spilling over, because the IRA in the last week of August, they blow up Lord Mountbatten and Mullaghmore and three others, including two children. There's the same day, the Warren Point ambush, 18 soldiers killed. And you know, that's all obviously causing eruptions down here. And in that very same week, the Department of Agriculture gets an anonymous letter bashed out on an old typewriter. And the first line says, "Dear Minister, to get straight to the point, this is a demand for £5 million. And the reason they're looking for £5 million is because if they're paid, they will not go ahead and release the deadliest and most costliest disease that could afflict any country, in particular an agricultural country, they say, namely foot and mouth disease." So they're claiming, this anonymous gang, to have isolated a sample of foot and mouth disease that they are threatening to release into the national herd at a time when the Irish economy is essentially an agricultural economy. Yes.
What are we talking about now? What's the equivalent of 5 million?
30 million.
30 million?
Yeah.
30 million. Yeah. So today's equivalent is 30 million.
Good chunk of change.
Yes, So some unfortunate in the Department of Agriculture opens this up. It's brought to the attention of the Gardaí immediately.
Yeah, I mean, it goes up the line in the department, and then they bring in the guards,
Right.
And then this sort of cat and mouse operation starts up. I mean, obviously the gang must have known the guards have been brought in, but the guards never identify themselves. So the guards are constantly going through the private secretary to the minister, who's a man called Kevin Cassidy. And so he becomes, even though the guards are handling the correspondence at the department end, it's they're using
he's the contact.
He's the contact. Yeah.
And it's like I shouldn't laugh because it's serious, but it reads like a movie, doesn't it?
Oh, it does.
And if Pat Short was in that movie and Brendan Gleeson, like, you wouldn't be surprised.
So that's it. It reads like a movie, and the kind of movie it would be is a caper movie.
Yes, a caper movie. Yes, you know?
And you'd be kind of on the side of the gang. They'd have this eccentric, wacky plot.
Yes,
And they'd probably have some good reason to need the 5 million. And
oddly, you talked to this guy, Professor Gulati, who's a forensic psychiatrist, and he says to you that after examining the letters, that it's very likely that they came from intelligent people who'd been to college.
Now we have
to remember back in the 1970s that a very small percentage of people in Ireland went to college. I think it was as low as, it was in single figures anyway, as opposed to what we have
figures
today.
Tiny compared to now. It was an interesting thing about the 1970s. One thing we know from our politics is that there are a number of a generation that kind of on the edge of retirement, have retired now, who became very serious politicians and ministers, and people also in the kind of courts and stuff, who started out in very radical politics. And in fact, Charlie Bird started out in very radical politics in the early 70s. And so there was, the 1968, you had the sort of student disturbances rising across Europe. So you had this intermixing of, here you had republicanism, you also had student activism, you had hard left activism, Trotskyism, blending into more traditional kind of left-wing working class activism, and fringe movements within the left-wing Labour parties or outside of them. So there was this kind of milieu there where you had, kind of people from quite well-to-do backgrounds, professional backgrounds, university educated, getting pulled in through political interests, mixing with people who were more hardline, whether it was militant Republican or criminal.
Okay,
and kind of a blending of things, and some people just got sucked into this.
Now, people listening at home are going, "I never heard of this. Why now? What happened back then? How was it kept a secret?" Gerry Collins was the Minister for Justice at the time. He didn't know about it.
Yeah, in fairness to Jerry, he had a lot going on at the time.
Right.
In fact, he was under constant guard of protection. Right. There were threats against him. So
no, I'm not saying it's any reflection of him. It's just
He didn't explicitly say he didn't know about it, but he didn't say he was familiar with it.
Okay.
Ray McSharry was Minister for Agriculture, and what Ray McSharry did say was, Ray remembered it, a laser-like memory for it, and was very clear. He did not share it.
Right.
He did not bring it to
And
the
you were saying a cat and mouse thing. So the letter writers, alias Tom Smith, wanted the Department of Agriculture to communicate with them through the small ads at the back of the Irish Times.
Exactly. Well, they couldn't give them an address, and there wasn't email. So yes, take out a small ad in the Irish Times saying Tom Smith has received your message, and is awaiting further instructions.
So they signed off as Tom Smith, and they wanted the Department of Agriculture to call themselves Tom Smith as well at the back of the Irish Times.
There was lots of slightly comical quirks in this kind of caper aspect.
It was
sort of
the code name anyway for the whole thing. Operation Tom Smith. So letters go to and fro, the small ads go to and fro. Then it gets to a point where they're asking them to park a Mini outside the Gresham. So that was August, and come February the next year. So that's how many?
1980.
What's that? Nearly 6 months.
Six, seven months.
This Operation Blackjack.
Yeah. So Blackjack is the name the guards give the response to it. So basically what the gang are doing is they're making quite difficult demands. They want 5 million. They want it in different currencies, Deutsche Mark, Swiss francs. They want some passports. And they're very clear with their instructions about how they want it delivered. It's going to be a Mini 100 with British reg plates, white. And that's going to drive this long loop out of Dublin down to Waterford. And back up through Wicklow at 45 miles per hour, carrying extra petrol
it's
in
like
the back.
Speed. You can't go over 45 reverse, miles an hour.
Yeah. But obviously that's so the gang can work out where that car supposedly with the ransom will be at any time, and it's to spread out the guard resources.
And the letter says that now you won't have enough petrol in the tank to do the full loop from Dublin down through Kilcullen, Athy, Castlecomer, on to New Ross, Waterford, and back up through Enniscorthy. So you should bring 2 10-litre gallons. It wouldn't have been litres back then. It would have been 10, whatever. What's 10 litres in gallons? Anyway, it would have been two
jerry cans.
Containers of petrol, and you've to refuel on the bridge in New Ross.
Yeah.
This was all in the type letter, one of the type letters.
Exactly, yeah. This is the final letter.
Okay.
The details of the demand, And so obviously the guards go for that. Well, so first of all, this long route at the slow speed means that the gang can intercept anywhere. But they're also specifying you're to refuel here. So the guards think, well, that's probably where they're going to intercept.
Yes.
And so it's the bridge at New Ross. That's Waterford Estuary. It's a route out to sea. The guards happen to know there was somebody with criminal associations locally who had a speedboat, and they thought, okay, so maybe they're going to intercept here, and they're going to chuck
the five million over the bridge.
Over the bridge, speedboat and out to sea.
Right.
So the guards brought in the Navy. So there were 2 naval ships in Waterford Estuary.
Out around Dunmore East or thereabouts waiting for them.
Exactly, yeah. We spoke, in fact, to the captain of one of them. Yeah, remembered it well. The Navy, curiously, don't have powers of arrest, so they have to have special branch on board the ships with them, so they intercept and then the guards descend.
Now, in this feature-length documentary, you spoke to Willie McGee from the Fraud Squad, you spoke to Tom Connolly, and you sort of solve... We're not... Spoiler alert. You solved the mystery.
Yeah, so the guards had one lead, and we're not going to go into the details of kind of who that was here and now and stuff. We get well into it in the film, but it was very tentative. They were quite confident, but they'd nothing hard at all. And yeah, we got a lot further. We got a lot further.
Right.
And we kind of got this portrait of a gang and a pattern of jobs, and which also made the story a lot darker.
Of course, and then you can see your attitude towards them, because it turns from a caper movie in your head to something a lot more sinister.
Exactly,
and people lose their lives. So, it's multi-layered and it's hugely interesting. And to get back to then Charlie, and we can see poor Charlie deteriorate through the documentary. And there are moments where he tells the crew to stop filming because he's so uncomfortable. How were you with all of that? Because, he was telling you pretty heavy, intimate, personal stuff.
Yeah, like it was a real privilege, you know, and like I'm a journalist as well, and I was working with Charlie, a journalist, and we're both storytellers, and so you know we've both separately been in situations where you're asking people difficult things, and you're documenting difficult stories. So in one sense it was consistent with that. In another, it was very different. This is a very good friend of mine, and he'd really invited us into that process. I mean, we always knew the film was always going to be Ransom 79, but we always knew it was going to be those two things. It was going to be about the story, but also about this veteran journalist trying to keep doing the thing he loved, even as he was fighting this terminal illness. And like the early stages of filming, you know, with the director and producer and camera and stuff, were difficult because we were trying to work that out with Charlie and with Charlie's wife, Claire. What do we have permission to do? You know, like, and so we were very quick early on to turn off the camera. And then we discussed it with him and realised, well, actually, he wanted to tell this story as well. He wanted to tell the story of living.
He says it in the documentary, and it's very poignant, that it was keeping him alive. It was giving him a focus and a purpose.
Yes, yeah. And Claire's wife says that as well. Like, the thing that was literally keeping him alive was the love and care of the
realm. I know,
But the days when he had something to do in Ransom 79 were the good days.
Okay. Where did he get the story from?
So Willie McGee, the retired head of the Fraud Squad, Charlie was looking for some stories for a series of podcasts he was doing for Senior Times a few years ago. Talked to an old friend said, have you ever talked to Willie McGee? And Willie literally got in touch and said, have you, Willie? And everybody knows Charlie.
Yeah.
Got any stories? And Willie said, well, actually, as it happens, I have this story that I've never told. Willie was working on a memoir at the same time, and he was writing up the story for his memoir as well. Right. It's a lovely book. Tales from the Fraud Squad.
The other relationship that we are introduced to in the documentary is between Pat McCann, who served 33 years in prison for the killing of a member of An Garda Síochána, and a retired Garda, Tom Connolly. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting as well. That's why I'm saying it's multi-layered. It's all men, all in you know, men having relationships.
All men, old men. You know, and there was a lot of there's a lot of mortality in this film, you know. Yeah. And so Pat McCann had died just a couple of years before. Tom Connolly was, I think, 89 when we first met him. Another veteran, kind of retired, a very senior, very successful detective. Like, amazing life in him. And actually, something we mentioned to him while we were there, so to see, and he went off and did some investigation on his own. On his
at
own
80,
bat.
At 80.
And he acted, yeah. Tom actually, he got ill then, he died the same day as Charlie. He was an incredible person. But he had put Pat McCann away, right, back in 1980. And the film tells the story of what it was all about. Mm. And when he heard McCann was out, and he'd heard he was also out, but in bad way, McCann was very damaged by prison and institutionalised, wasn't really surviving on the outside. And Connolly went and looked him up. Now, he had a bit of an ulterior motive.
He did. But his humanity was there as well.
He went to record conversations, but actually he ended up kind of helping to look after him.
Yeah.
And he was one of the few people who went to McCann's funeral then. So they struck up this, and Tom uses the phrase, he says, look, this man, you know, he shot or was involved in the shooting of two of my colleagues, you know. But yet we formed this, and he almost says friendship.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, there's a relationship there.
He said he's not an enemy. Exactly. That's what he said. Yeah. So, Ransom 79, it's a great watch. It's in cinemas nationwide from May 24th. That's last Friday. So
exactly,
it's
somewhere out. Yeah, right there.
And will it ever appear on the telly?
In 12 months or maybe a little less, it'll be on Virgin, actually.
Uh-huh.
Virgin Media.
Right. Part funded by Virgin. Colin Murphy, thanks for coming in. Thanks so much.
Delighted, Ray. Thank you.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.